Conversations.
Hello, thanks for listening to Med Conversations. I'm Beck and I'm here with Scott. And today we're going to be talking about hyponatremia.
So this is a super common problem on the ward, probably the most common electrolyte disturbance. So
this is the most common thing you're ever going to see.
Most common illness even, maybe.
And sodium is one of the most common cations.
In the blood. So thanks for that. Great segue, Beck. So going straight into it. So Beck, what's the normal range of sodium in the blood?
So normal range is about 135 to 145.
And the key thing there is that in hyponatremia, it's usually a problem of too much water, not insufficient salt. So you've got probably about the same amount of salt in a lot of the cases, but you've got way too much water, so your concentration of salt is low.
Yeah, and so hyponatremia is, as we said, one of the most common things you see. About 60% of inpatients have some kind of hyponatremia, regardless of what the cause of their admission is. And I think it matters because it kills people. It keeps people in hospital longer, and like we said, we see it all the time. So we figured we might as well talk about it.
So, Beck, I think you've done your homework. What are we going to talk about today?
Yeah, so we're going to go through the physiology of sodium handling. We'll talk about acute versus chronic, which is a question that I think we always have to ask ourselves when it comes to hyponatremia. Clinical presentation, approach to finding a cause, and then we'll discuss ward-based management and how to avoid the pitfalls of overcorrection.
Sounds riveting. Let's go. Let's hop straight in.
So what's the deal? You mentioned before that the problem is too much water and not insufficient salt.
Yeah, so if you remember back to kind of high school biology or first year med school, in your blood you've got a concentration of different solutes, and that's what determines its tonicity, and that's what drives osmosis across all the different membranes that are going on. So sodium is the most important cation, so the most important positively charged ion in your blood. So it's the biggest contributor to that concentration there. And so there's kind of four key hormones that regulate your sodium and your water in your blood. So do you know what they are, Beck?
I do. Thanks for asking. So the main one is ADH, which is antidiuretic hormone. And I think the thing that gets really confusing here is that it's got lots of different names. So we're going to be calling it ADH today, but the other names are AVP or vasopressin.
That is really confusing.
So that's hormone number one. And the job of the ADH, which I'll talk about in more detail in a moment, promotes water reabsorption in the kidney. That's the main thing that one does. And then there's aldosterone.
So ADH was for water. Aldosterone is also called salt-retaining hormone because it's about sodium reabsorption. And remembering that once you reabsorb sodium, you also reabsorb water with it because water will follow sodium in your kind of osmotic gradients.
And then you've got your atrial natriuretic peptide and brain natriuretic peptide. What's the role of those?
So they're produced by cells in the heart muscle in response to being stretched. So they're kind of, they're natriuretic peptides. So instead of being, so naturesis means excretion of salt. So they're hormones that your body makes when the heart feels like it's being stretched too much, basically. So it says that you've got too much intravascular volume. So your body makes this hormone and it helps push out salt, and with it volume, because the water follows the salt.
Yeah, so, and like we said, the main thing controlling water is the ADH. So just to give a really brief overview of what ADH is all about. So it's secreted from the posterior pituitary, and the things that stimulate it are predominantly the serum osmolality. So if your osmolality in your blood gets above about 285, then in response to that, the ADH will be secreted. A couple of other things that influence it are the blood volume and the blood pressure to a lesser extent. And even some things like nausea and pain can stimulate the release of ADH.
What ADH does is it increases the amount of aquaporins in your collecting duct, which stops the excretion of water.
Yeah, so you insert these in and then the water stays in the body. So in patients who have a low effective arterial circulating blood volume, whatever the cause of that is, ADH release is physiological and it helps to pump up the circulating volume. So some of the things that can cause low effective circulating volume are hypovolemia, like someone who's really dehydrated, or edematous conditions like heart failure where there is intravascular depletion. So it's hemodynamically appropriate in these situations to release ADH. The syndrome of inappropriate ADH is when the release of ADH is happening but is not hemodynamically appropriate. So when the ADH is incompletely suppressed despite there being a low plasma tonicity.
So to say that really simply, basically you're secreting too much ADH in SAADH.
When you shouldn't be.
Yep.
Okay, so an approach to hyponatremia, Scott, where do you start?
So first we want to get two things out of the way. So we want to know whether it's a hypotonic hyponatremia. So as we said, your sodium is your main cation in your blood, which is kind of producing its tonicity, so its concentration of solute in the blood. So if your sodium is low, your overall concentration of solute in your blood should be low. So that would be a hypotonic hyponatremia. So if it's an isotonic or a hypertonic hyponatremia, then we put it in another category. And the other thing to think about is whether it's a pseudo-hyponatremia. So Beck, what's a pseudo-hyponatremia?
So pseudo-hyponatremia is looking at whether there's a measurement issue that's making it appear to be hyponatremic, even when it's not. So in really extreme hyperlipidemia, not just your average person who's got slightly high LDL, but extreme hyperlipidemia where you do a blood sample and it looks like a strawberry milkshake, the blood, when looked at in a lab, seems to have less sodium for that amount of volume. So it looks like it's hyponatremic. But in the actual bit of serum that's floating around those globules of fat, the concentration of sodium is in fact normal. So you get around that by doing a blood gas. Hyperproteinemia does the same thing. So high protein states might be like multiple myeloma, or if you have too much bulk mass gain, protein bars, then...
Back after a marathon.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. No, they're disgusting. So high lipids and high protein, and really high, can make it look like you have hyponatremia, and that's pseudo-hyponatremia. Another thing that gets called pseudo-hyponatremia that strictly isn't is hyperglycemic states. So the way that works... Oh, Scott, do you want to explain it? No. Okay, so the way that... He's shaking his head. So glucose is osmotically active. So in patients who have very, very high blood sugars, like blood sugars of 50, 60... The water is being drawn out of the cells via osmosis because there's so much sugar floating around there in the ocean around the cells. And because all that water is coming out into the serum, the sodium is being diluted. So what you need to do there to get a true sodium measurement is to get your MedCalc app on your phone and correct the sodium level for the glucose.
So if I understand that correctly, even though your sodium is lower, because glucose is doing the same thing that that extra sodium would be doing anyway, the tonicity is the same. You don't really care.
Exactly.
Okay. Cool. See, I could explain it at the end.
All right. So then I thought we could have a look at what the symptoms are of hyponatremia. And this is pretty boring because they're pretty vague.
I don't know. Obtundation's pretty fun. It's a cheeky little symptom. So, yeah. So I guess like Beck said, there's kind of two kind of categories of symptoms. So... the first ones are these really vague set of symptoms that people can get. And these are things like fatigue, nausea, dizziness, gait disturbance, bit of confusion, muscle cramps. You know, I think a lot of kind of old ladies being admitted into a gen med ward are going to have some combination of those symptoms. And then you've got your really kind of severe symptoms. So that's when people kind of drop their GCS, become obtunded, they can have seizures, go into comas. And they're the ones that we obviously really worry about.
Yeah, so the endpoint there is usually respiratory arrest. And these are the kind of symptoms that happen when the sodium is very low, like less than 120. And generally only in acute. So what actually is acute? What's the time frame? What's the cutoff there?
I think it's 42 hours, is it?
48.
Yeah. Going off the Mayan calendar. You know.
So generally, we say 48 hours is the cutoff, but it's sort of 24 to 48 hours. And when you have a patient who comes in and has a measured sodium that's low, you can't always tell whether it's acute or chronic unless the history is really compelling, like they've just run a marathon today and they've had 7 liters of water, or unless they actually had a blood test yesterday. And if you don't know, then you just need to assume that it's chronic.
Yeah, because as we'll talk about later, it's the important thing in chronic hypernatremia, if you take nothing else out of this, is not to correct it too quickly.
Mm. So I think that the reason for that is best understood by just understanding the physiology in general. So if you've got an acute reduction in your sodium, then you're also acutely reducing the osmolality. And as with any other situation where this happens in the body, that can create a gradient of fluid. So if there's low osmolality in the serum, water goes into the cells and makes them swell. So it's causing swelling of the brain cells, which causes cerebral edema. But then if the sodium isn't acutely reduced, if it's a gradual reduction in sodium, or if it's been reduced for over that 24 to 48 hours, then there's an adaptive response where the brain cells, instead of just swelling, they send some of their solutes out of the cells into the surrounding fluid, and into the hypoosmolar sea, they float these extra solutes. And then that means that cerebral edema, the swelling of those cells, doesn't occur.
Mm. So they like turn up the temperature of the tonicity bath that they're in.
Yeah.
That's a...
yeah, you could say that shitty metaphor.
Yeah.
And then if you undo that, if you reverse the hyponatremia, then those processes are also reversed. But then I think the thing that's really interesting here and really terrifying is that those adaptive mechanisms that happen, those brain solutes that were lost as part of the adaptive mechanism to reduce swelling, are taken back in more slowly than they were initially lost. So if you're fixing the problem, if you're fixing the hyponatremia, then the brain takes longer to undo the thing that it did to prevent the edema, and that basically causes all hell to break loose, and you can get something called osmotic demyelination syndrome, which used to be called central pontine myelinosis.
So basically it kills people, and that's the whole reason we care about sodium correction. Like, yeah. You need to be really careful you don't give them too much or give them any hypertonic saline unless you speak to someone very qualified in the task, as Beck will be shortly.
Yeah, so I think... This is really the main crux of all of this, that hyponatremia can be really bad, but fixing hyponatremia too quickly can be really, really bad. So what it causes is severe neurological deficits that can happen a few days down the track but then last forever.
All right. So to summarize all the stuff we've been saying so far, you've got a few different hormones in your body that control your salt and your water together, but antidiuretic hormone, ADH, also known as... AVP or vasopressin, is the most important one for specifically regulating water rather than water together with sodium. And Beck, what are the three kind of first questions when you first find a patient with hyponatremia?
So the first one is, could this be a pseudo-hyponatremia or a hypertonic hyponatremia? So I'm thinking about, what's the blood sugar, what's the protein, and what are the lipids?
And is the patient symptomatic? Do they have some of those vague symptoms of confusion, nausea, headache, or are they
actively seizing?
Are they seizing in front of you? Yeah, it's probably quite obvious.
And then the third question is this acute or chronic, with 48 hours being the cutoff? So I think once you know these things, then you can start looking at what could the cause be.
So now we get into these wonderfully long flow charts. I think there's one in Up to Date, which you could probably fit across about 6 kind of A4 pages stuck together. And you can kind of choose which flow chart you like for kind of looking at the different causes of hyponatremia. But they're actually pretty useful because, I mean, you can actually just sit there with one, look it up on your computer or whatever, and you can look down through all the different causes with all the different blood results and urine results and decide.
Yeah, so I think this is where the robots are going to be helping us out a lot. Hyponatremia is something that can be very algorithmic. So I think what is best to do is actually to pick your flow chart that suits you. So if you're a med student, not so important, but if you're an intern or a resident, if you're already in a hospital, if you have your phone with you now, look up European Journal of Clinical Investigation, hyponatremia, and there's a wonderful flow chart there. There's one on Life in the Fast Lane that's great, and there's one on Up to Date. And we're going to be talking about a bit of a mash up of all of those three flow charts, but when you're physically on the ward, just going through these algorithms can be immensely helpful.
Mm. And the European Journal one has three different colours.
Yeah, the colour coding is really nice.
Mm. Very friendly and kind of colourful. So what are we up to? Approach. So when a patient first comes in with hypernatremia, one of the first things you should do is you should try and get a paired serum and urine osmolality and sodium. So when the patient comes into ED, if the ED refers you over the phone, or if you're maybe the internal resident admitting the patient in ED, before you give fluids, you should make sure you get a set of blood sent off at the same time that the patient has a wee.
Yeah, and this sounds like it would be pretty easy to do, but it's extremely hard and it never happens. So what you need to write on the slip is one slip for serum and you're asking for osmolality and a UEC, and then another slip for urine and again asking for osmolality and sodium. I stable them together. I tell the patient, I tell the nurse, I tell anyone who's going to listen, because it's very hard to make sure that this happens before anything else is given to the patient. So you do that, number one. Number two, you want to look to see if there are any possibly offending medications, so any medications that might be causing hyponatremia, and stop them. And then number three, you need to do a fluid review. If the patient is dry, give them normal saline. That'll usually fix the problem. If they're edematous, treat the underlying cause. Treat the heart failure, treat the renal failure. Or if they're euvolemic or you're not sure what their fluid status is, keep listening.
Mm, gets more complicated, just to make it even more fun. So as we were talking about, we've got this hypertonic or isotonic hypernatremia, and that's what we're not going to talk too much about today. But there were some of those causes, like really high sugars, really high proteins, really high lipids in the blood, that give you those other causes. And then we've got hypotonic hypernatremia, which is what we'll be talking about for the rest of the podcast.
And so to be clear, so what we're talking about now is what are the causes of hyponatremia? And specifically, what are the causes of hypotonic hypernatremia? So number one, hypovolemia. So that'd be the usual things that can cause hypovolemia. So your dehydration, post-surgery, post-massive bleed, diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, that kind of thing.
Seven different abdominal tubes, like all random stuff.
Yep.
And next is hypervolemic. So basically heart failure, liver failure, kidney failure. So on the ward, probably all the kind of oldies with mild heart failure might be the most common cause of a hypernatremia on a gen med ward.
And then there's the euvolemic ones. So usually this is SAADH or syndrome of inappropriate ADH, where there's too much of the ADH. And this can lead to high urinary sodium, which is inappropriate. The second one would be self-induced water intoxication. So something like primary polydipsia. This is the person who's drinking liters and liters of water every day. Or my favourite, have you heard of beer potomania?
I have. And because in Victoria we call small beers pots, I always thought it was because they drank too many pots.
No, I thought too.
And then I found out it comes out from some Greek word for river, potos or something. So there you go. It's not because we call beers pots in Victoria. Beer potomania. Yeah.
So the story with that one is that you're drinking lots of fluid without much salt and usually without much other nutrition in the diet. And similar to that is the tea and toast diet, which again, all the oldies are on as well, which is a very low solute, high dilute water diet.
Yeah, so you're drinking too much volume past the maximal kind of dilutional capacity of your kidneys, basically.
That's it. And then some rarer causes to think about are adrenal insufficiency and hypothyroidism. So they need to make it onto your blood slips. I think that's enough of the theory. So we'll just dive into some cases now.
So, Beck, tell me about Lena Lowe.
Lena Lowe is a 76-year-old lady who's been brought in by ambulance after an unwitnessed fall, found after a local teenage drone operator found her when flying over her backyard with a video camera. And I had a patient with this presenting complaint.
It's just a classic, isn't it? It's a really common kind of scenario.
Oh, welcome to the 21st century. So Lena Lowe, she's been found in her backyard. She's fine. Her past medical history is a bit boring. She's got hypertension, gout, atrial fibrillation. Initial bloods are back. She's got a blood sugar of 8, which is important because we're checking to see if there's an extremely high sugar that might be causing her sodium to be low, and there's not. Her FBE is unremarkable. And she has a sodium of 128, so remembering that the lower limit of normal is 135. Her renal function's normal and she's had a normal CT brain. So now we're going to go through that approach again. So Scott, what was the first thing that we're looking at?
So we're checking whether it's a real hyponatremia, so a hypotonic hyponatremia, or whether it's a pseudo hyponatremia.
Yeah, so we've mentioned the blood sugar is fine. You have a look at her liver function test. There's no abnormal protein there. She doesn't have a history of multiple myeloma. Her blood looks normal and there's no known extreme hyperlipidemia in her history. So we think that this is probably going to be your stock standard hypotonic hyponatremia. Is she symptomatic or not? Well, I guess this is something for debate. She doesn't have any seizures. She doesn't have an altered conscious state, but she's come in after a fall, and falls can be much more common in patients who have chronic hyponatremia. So possibly.
Mm. So, and is it acute or chronic? A bit hard to tell, but yeah, I guess we don't really know. It depends whether the hyponatremia was kind of an underlying cause for a fall, or maybe secondary to the fall, she's had some dehydration or something else which has caused a hyponatremia.
Yeah, but I think the really important point here is that you don't know, so that if you're going to guess something, you guess that it's chronic.
Mm.
And this is a good thing that an intern can do, is call up the GP and find out when their last blood test was. If they happen to have had a blood test yesterday and it was normal, then you know it's acute and you're going to manage it in a very different way. So the cutoff again, 48 hours, and we are going to assume that this is chronic because we don't know that it's acute.
So next we'll be thinking about the cause, and that'll probably be once we start getting some of the results back and checking what treatment we do.
Yeah, so you've sent off your paired serum and urine osmolality and sodium before you did anything else, and then you're going to take a history. So the important bits on the history, apart from getting a solid past medical history like you always would, and getting a list of their medications. So we mentioned she's got hypertension, gout, and atrial fibrillation. Her medications are atorvastatin, paracetamol, hydrochlorothiazide, and allopurinol. Allopurinol.
Allopurinol. Yeah.
So I always like to get a good history about their fluid intake to figure out if they might have some primary polydipsia, alcohol use, what their diet is like. So she doesn't have anything exciting on the history of her fluid intake.
Mm.
And then the next thing you need to do is a fluid review, and she's euvolemic. So is there anything that you've heard so far, Scott, that's already pointing towards a possible cause?
Yeah, well, I think the big thing that sticks out there is hydrochlorothiazide. So thiazide diuretics are one of the most important causes of drug-induced hyponatremia.
Mm.
Yeah, go on.
It is the most common cause that we see in terms of offending medications. So while you're waiting to get the results of that paired serum and urine, you cross off the thiazides. So I guess first, how do thiazides actually work? Why do they cause hyponatremia?
So thiazides work at the distal convoluted tubule by blocking the thiazide-sensitive NaCl cotransporter. So that stops reabsorption of sodium and chloride from the distal convoluted tubule back into the renal interstitium and back into the blood. So that means you're stopping that reabsorption, so you're secreting more of your sodium, more of your water.
Mm, and that can also help to stimulate thirst, and so it's multifactorial. Thiazide diuretics are the most common, but other diuretics like indapamide, amiloride, and even loop diuretics like furosemide can contribute to hyponatremia. If patients are on these medications, it's really hard to interpret an osmolality and interpret the urine. So it's a good idea to just stop them and see how the patient goes. Do you know the other most common medications that can cause hyponatremia? Other things to look out for on a drug chart?
So apart from thiazide diuretics especially, you want to think about psychotropics?
Yeah, so any of the kind of brain drugs. So antidepressants like SSRIs are a big one, carbamazepine, the other anti-epileptics, and some of the antipsychotic drugs.
Some other drugs that occasionally can cause hyponatremia are omeprazole and PPIs, NSAIDs, cyclophosphamide, and haloperidol and amitriptyline, which are also psychotropics.
Okay, so we've got this Lena low. She's lying in a field. Well, she's been brought in from being lying in the field after the kid with the drone found her, which is definitely illegal. But
What was he doing? What was he looking for with that drone?
I don't know. I didn't take the history from him. I mean, I'm probably not protecting confidentiality of this local kid very well. But
not probably reconnaissancing for unwitnessed falls. I doubt that's what he was trying to do.
I think this is the gem in the home service.
Drone in the home.
I like it. Okay, so we've got the bloods back now. Serum sodium is 128, so it's pretty low, not terrible. Urine sodium is 48, which is high. Serum osmolality is high at 250, and the urine osmolality is lower than that at 220. But we already said she's on a thiazide, so all these numbers don't really mean a lot because it's difficult to interpret. She doesn't have any worrying symptoms, and it's not less than 120, so we don't need to jump into action straight away with any of the big guns, and we're pretty sure that the cause of this is thiazide. So we've talked a lot about trying not to overcorrect too quickly. So what is the goal? How do you want this sodium looking in the next 24 hours?
So you don't want to change it by more than 4 to 8 millimoles per 24-hour period. So you want to just slowly bring her sodium back up.
Yeah. So what we did with Lena Lowe is stopped her, all names have been changed, stopped her hydrochlorothiazide and changed it to another anti-hypertensive medication. And then the next day her sodium increased from 128 to 130, and then the next day to 133, and she was discharged home with a normal sodium of 135. She got a blood slip to check again with the GP in a week because you want to just keep a close eye on things.
Mm. And a drone check day 2 post-discharge.
As is the standard of care.
Protocol, yeah. So, case 2. Let's revise a bit more. Maria Mendelow was a previously well 52-year-old who presented with aspiration pneumonia following consumption of a needle-containing Australian strawberry. Very topical for the next about 4 days, I'm sure. So, on the initial testing, you get back a normal UNE apart from a sodium of 125 and a BSL of 5. So, what's your steps again, Beck? What are you looking at first?
So first, I've made sure that the blood sugar is normal, the LFTs aren't showing any extremes of proteinemia, and she doesn't have any extreme hyperlipidemia. So we're going to say this is probably a hypotonic hypernatremia and continue on our algorithm. She's asymptomatic. That was another important thing to check. And whether it's acute or chronic, in this case, we actually know because this patient who had been previously well had gone to her GP yesterday morning and had a blood test yesterday morning that showed a normal sodium. So it's dropped down in just 24 hours. Next step is figuring out what the cause is.
And what should we do to treat it? So you send off as paired serum and urine osmolality and sodium, and you take a history. And she's not on any regular medications, no past history. She's got, she was, after being unwell for 2 days, her GP told her to drink lots of water. And knowing that everyone already needs to drink 1.5 litres of water a day, she thought she would drink 4 times that and try and drink 6 litres of water a day. So she's been very polyuric.
Yeah, and you do a fluid review, and because she's got well-functioning kidneys in general, she's euvolemic.
And by the way, there's no evidence behind drinking 1.5 litres of water a day. I think some kind of advertising company just picked up on that, and people started thinking that doctors wanted people to do that. This is a little side note, little asterisk.
Yeah, I joined a gym once and I got told that I should try to drink 5 litres of water a day. That's what the gym guy told me.
Wow, that's dangerous.
It's dangerous.
If you're doing exercise as well, that's really dangerous.
Anyway, so this lady has a serum sodium of 125, so that's low, obviously. She's got a urine sodium of 10, which is really low. It's very dilute. Serum osmolality is 290, but urine osmolality is just 80. So she's basically just peeing out water. It's acute, not chronic, so less than 48 hours. She's asymptomatic. So knowing all those things, what's your management?
So fluid restrict. So it looks like she's drinking water higher than her kidney's maximal capacity to dilute her urine. So if you just restrict her fluid and stop the water coming in, then it should get better.
Yeah. So because it's acute, we have a very low risk of cerebral edema from rapid correction. So it's reasonable to aim for in excess even of 10 millimoles in 24 hours. So you put her on a 1 liter fluid restriction, check her bloods the next day, and it's 135. So it's these patients who improve extremely quickly.
So you discharge your home the next day and get a follow-up with the GP, drone check day 4, you know, standard.
Day two, sorry, Beck.
Let's follow guidelines here. Yeah. So these cases have been a bit kind of garden variety. What if you had a patient who came in really unwell? So a patient who's obtunded or is seizing or something like that. So what's the first thing you do as an ED resident, Beck?
You or ED call reg? Endocrinology.
You don't just whack in some hypertonic saline?
No. So you want to get off that paired urine and serum. And the indications, I think, for an urgent correction and definitely an endocrinology referral would be a sodium of less than 120 or cerebral symptoms. So that's things like a coma or seizure, stuff that you're not going to miss. And your target when you're trying to correct these should be no higher than 120. So usually you're only wanting to increase it by 3 or 4.
Yeah, and I think that's probably a good learning point around like kind of when endo cares. So if it's 3 a.m. and your patient is on a thiazide diuretic and has a bit of heart failure and has a sodium of 129, you could probably wait a couple of days before you call endo or maybe not even call endo if you've got a clear cause of your hyponatremia. So we're not going to talk about hypertonic saline because I think it's really important to remember, like we said before, that you don't want to cause any harm. So you probably shouldn't go around trying to correct things really acutely. It should definitely be done in ICU or in discussion with endo.
Mm. And then there are a few other options for correction that we won't go into too much, but vasopressin receptor antagonists. So this is your conivaptan and tolvaptan. They're new kids on the block. We've got them approved in Australia, but I don't think they're on the PBS yet. But I think the main thing to know is that whatever route you choose to correct hyponatremia, if you go too far, which people do all the time, it's really easy to overcorrect. You can undo it pretty easily by giving some IV dextrose, or if you get some specialist endocrine advice, you can give DDAVP. So essentially that's just giving ADH.
And as a general tip with management, that kind of 4 to 8 mmol/24 hours is actually pretty easy to overshoot. So just be pretty conservative in general with how you try and correct people. So case 4, Hedley Hithersbury. Did I say it right?
Hithersbury.
Tell me about Hedley.
So Hedley is an 85-year-old who has palpitations in the setting of learning that Australia has just rotated onto its 6th Prime Minister in 10 years.
Very topical episode, this one.
So very topical. Political. Yeah. We are in September 2018. His sodium is 128. So we're going to go through the usual things. I'm not going to labour it too much, but we've checked his sugars and his proteins and everything's all normal. He's asymptomatic. This is chronic. This is very chronic, actually. So you've called up his GP because you're a great intern and you found out that his sodium has been less than 130 for 3 years.
No one did anything.
No one's done anything yet.
Yet. Here we go. So we do the same things we've done before. So we send off the paired serum, urine osmolality, and sodium. And just on that one, actually, I know we didn't talk about it before, but even if they're like an hour or two different, you still might get some useful information out of it. So try and get them sent off at the same time.
An hour or two is fine. I struggle getting it on the same day.
Yeah, probably should be the same day. But send it off when you can. And depending on how kind of equivocal in the mid-range the result is or how extreme the result is, you still might get some useful information about how your kidneys are going concentrating your urine.
Yeah. Then you want to take a history. So his past medical history, he's got AF, osteoarthritis, COPD. You've checked his med chart. There's nothing worrying there. No thiazides, no psychotropics. His fluid and his diet is all pretty normal. And he's euvolemic on a fluid review. So there's really not that much to find. You finally get back your paired urine and serum. He's got a serum sodium of 125 and a urine sodium of 48. So that's high. That sounds inappropriate. His plasma osmolality is 250 and his urine is more concentrated than that at 280, which also sounds quite inappropriate.
It sounds very inappropriate.
So this is sounding like a syndrome of inappropriate ADH. Or something called a reset osmostat, which we probably won't go into. But if you're a BPT, you should go and look it up. But these are a diagnosis of exclusion. So we've got to look through and make sure it's not a couple of other things first. So this is where you get out the blood slips and you want to check to make sure they don't have cortisol deficiency. So you would do a morning cortisol and an ACTH stimulation test. And you'll send off some thyroid function tests. And if all of those things are normal, then you can call this the syndrome of inappropriate ADH.
Yeah, so syndrome of producing too much ADH, antidiuretic hormone. So that's in syndrome of inappropriate ADH, because you're secreting way too much antidiuretic hormone, you're retaining all this extra fluid. So you get a low serum osmolality and sodium, but in your urine, it's actually quite high. So instead of getting rid of all this extra fluid through your urine, your body's actually concentrating your urine. So you'll have a high urine osmolality and high urinary sodium.
Yeah, and the causes are many and varied. Lots of the causes are respiratory, so even pneumonia, asthma, atelectasis can do it, as well as the more severe things like acute respiratory failure. Malignancies like small cell lung cancer, which can actually produce ectopic ADH, but also other kinds of malignancies. A few problems in the brain box with strokes, infections and trauma. Then just in general, surgery, some medications, it can be hereditary. Even nausea can cause SAADH.
And everyone's favourite cause, idiopathic.
All right, so what do we do? How do we treat it? What's the first line?
So first line, you want to fluid restrict because they've got way too much water on board.
Yeah, so on the Australian therapeutic guidelines, they suggest 500 mils to 1 litre. And what you decide on will depend on lots of things. It's often a bit of trial and error, and you just need to monitor very closely. And I always find that the patient's humanness gets in the way of things if you try to be too algorithmic. If you do want to be very specific about it, you can have a look at the European guidelines that have a sophisticated calculation, but generally what's done on the wards is a bit of a guess at what's going to work.
And you can always start off with a more conservative fluid restriction and then increase it in a couple of days. Increase it, meaning like restrict it.
Yep. Increase it as in decrease it.
Yep.
I also mentioned earlier the vasopressin receptor antagonists, which are indicated in SAADH, but we don't really use them yet in Australia. Okay, so management in general, not just for SAADH, but summary of management for hyponatremia. Firstly, if there's a causative drug, stop it. If you think they're dry, give normal saline. If you're not sure, but they're definitely not overloaded, then you can trial slow sodium chloride. And if you think they're euvolemic, fluid restriction is a pretty good place to start. If you want to try something else, make an endocrinology referral first, but the options would be hypertonic saline, tolvaptan, and probably moving to a more closely monitored environment like their intensive care unit.
Yeah, if they're seizing, they should probably be in ICU.
Probs, yeah.
Probs. So, almost finished this scintillating lecture on...
Scintillating?
Scintillating? Is that even how you say it? I'm not even sure. Scintillating. Scintillating? Scintillating. Probably scintillating.
All right, let's give you...
Moving on.
The take-home points. So the first one, we've said it a billion times, but send the urine and serum osmolalities early before the patient is given any IV therapy.
The most common medications which cause it are particularly thiazide diuretics, more than the other ones, but also indapamide and psychotropics.
Choose an algorithm flowchart that you like and stick to it. So life in the fast lane one or the one on up to date.
Don't overcorrect. If it's chronic, correct really slowly. And remember that you can cause more harm than good if you trigger the central pontine, the new name, osmotic demyelination syndrome. That's right. Yep.
So in general, do less and measure it more. And lastly, salt and water can be dangerous, and specialty advice is a good idea here because when you go wrong, you can go very wrong.
So hopefully you've followed us along there through the depths of our discussion of electrolyte derangements, and now you, like Beck, have been through that marathon and are ready to run your own marathon in a physical sense. And you've learnt about the word scintillating, or at least learnt that you need to look it up like me, which I will do soon. But even if you didn't like this podcast, if you've liked any of our other podcasts, like us on Facebook or recommend it to a friend maybe, and yep, recommend them specifically, maybe not this one. No, I think it was.
Congratulations to the three or four of you who might have made it this far. Thank you so much for all the support. We love the messages that people send through. Hopefully this sound quality is a bit better than the last one, so sorry about that. And thank you for posting on the Facebook page, liking the likes, and we will see you next time.
Catch you soon.
Bye.